When the Children's Aid Society is considering whether or not they're going to do a baby snatching or a kidnapping, they have to consult a document called the Eligibility Spectrum. The Eligibility Spectrum was written, it was created originally back in 1996, not by the Ministry of Community and Social Services, not by professors, like some kind of a study group, professors in social work and child protection and law, they didn't create it. The Eligibility Spectrum was created by the Children's Aid Society's very own public relations firm and lobbyist organization, the Ontario Association of Children's Aid Societies, which gets $8 million of our taxpayers' dollars every year to operate. The Children's Aid Society's public relations firm authored the document which they have to consult prior to doing a baby snatching or a kidnapping. Come on, Government of Ontario. You know, how bad is it going to get? Justice Mary Jane Hatton, Superior Court Judge. She's on that DVD that we watched there, The Best Practices in the Conduct of a Child Protection File. Former CAS lawyer. Responsible for how many Crown Ward orders? Who knows? She, back in 1998, was the primary driving force in this document, this report that was produced, which resulted in the changes to the Child and Family Services Act in 1999, Bill 6. So you had a former CAS lawyer behind these changes being made. Conflict of interest after conflict of interest. The Commission to Promote Sustainable Children's Aid Societies, which magically changed its name to the Commission to Promote Sustainable Child Welfare. Three commissioners. One, a former Children's Aid Society, I think Toronto Children's Aid Society, Babies and Children Apprehensionist Specialist. That's one of the commissioners. The other one of the other commissioners, former Children's Aid Society Board of Director. All three of the commissioners are adopters. I imagine they've adopted their children from the Children's Aid Society. When these commissions are formed by the government has to submit these individuals' names to something called the Standing Committee on Government Agencies. These three individuals' names were not submitted to the Standing Committee on Government Agencies. They were just ushered right into these positions. Conflict of interest, perversion of the processes over and over and over again. The Civil Rules Committee and the Family Law Rules Committee. Why haven't they done anything to change the system for the better so that families aren't being unnecessarily destroyed? And then the incredible disappearing law, as Mr. McQuaid from FixCAS.com called it. Back on December 31st, 2011, the Government of Ontario allowed sections 184 to section 191 to be repealed, the Child and Family Services Act. Section 184 to section 191, they allowed those sections to be removed from the Act. Guess what those sections deal with? Those sections, which had been part of the Act for, I believe, 9 full years and had never been proclaimed, deal with the right of citizens to get their Children's Aid Society records, to get their Children's Aid Society files. The government had that section in the Child and Family Services Act for 9 full years. All it took was for one of the ministers to pick up the phone and call the lieutenant governor and say, go ahead and proclaim this section, and they never did. And the reason why they don't do it is because contained in the Children's Aid Society's records are evidence of fraud and malfeasance, incompetence, and that's why they don't allow us to have those records.
And neglect.
Neglect, abuse, perversion of the processes. And I mean, when's it going to stop? Okay, now, sorry, just on a more positive note, coming up this year. For me personally, on September 8th, 2012, I've been on a 2-year ban, actually much longer than that, a 2.5-year ban from protesting in front of the 2 Children's Aid Society's offices and the 3 courthouses in the region of Waterloo. But on September 8th, 2012, that ban is finished. Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society, you're going to be seeing a lot of me then. opening September 12, 2012. Opening of the courts in Toronto. I know.
Everyone's got to go to that one.
September 12, 2012. You can, Chad and myself, Bobby and Pat, and our great buddy Gordy Merton, we paid them a little unexpected, unannounced visit last year, and I believe that Pat got some video from that. And anyways, we'll go back this year, and the interfaith service begins at 10 a.m. at the Church of the Holy Trinity, 10 Trinity Square, Ontario. So obviously, let's get out there in full force.
Can we actually go to the church?
Yep, yep. And I know I personally will be in the church, and I know obviously everybody will comport themselves in a manner that is befitting of being in a church. And then when we get outside, we can let the judges know what we think. Freedom of speech, freedom of peaceful assembly, freedom of expression, freedom of conscience. Section 507.1 of the Criminal Code of Canada, private prosecutions. This is one of the strategies and tactics that we need to employ more often. And we need to become expert at this. It's not easy to do, but we need to utilize this process to get some justice against the Children's Aid Societies. Chris York and Pat, for the work that they did in publicizing that whole issue of motion for the immediate return of children. There are 11 judges' decisions posted to Canada Court Watch's Facebook page under the documents section. Section 51.3 of the Child and Family Services Act. If you utilize this section, you put the onus on the Children's Aid Society. You obligate them to prove to the court that the child can't be protected in the home under a supervision order. Some of the things that we're going to be looking at is Children's Aid Societies taking out life insurance policies on Crown wards. Even more disgusting and nefarious, Children's Aid Societies taking out life insurance policies on medically fragile babies who they expect to die in the next couple of months.
And in Sophie X's case, they actually were increasing the likelihood of death by not providing any maternal contact to the child.
Exactly. And there's another case that we know of where they absolutely took action to push that innocent, precious, beautiful little baby towards death. And the fact that we've submitted these inquiries to the Ministry of Children and Youth Services, the fact that we've submitted these inquiries to the Ontario Association of Children's Aid Societies and the CASs, and they come back and say, we have no knowledge. Can you believe the Ministry of Children and Youth Services response when I asked them, are the Children's Aid Societies taking out life insurance policies on Crown wards and medically fragile children? The Ministry of Children and Youth Services responded, we have no knowledge of that issue. How is that possible? They are frauds and liars. They are the most obscene and perverted threat to the protection of children and the integrity of families that have ever existed. We want to continue to, I think one of the things that we can do as Canada Court Watch, and I mean we already do a fair bit of work already, but things like getting specific motions drawn up and posted to the internet. Because, I mean, I try to utilize the law myself, and that's always a daunting task for me in terms of knowing exactly how to word the motions. I think that's one of the things that we can do. Get these motions onto the internet so families can just print them off. And also, in terms of coming up with exhibits that families can add to their affidavits, and you know, stuff like the case law, or there are three university professors who have done a lot of work in terms of trying to assist families. Nicholas Bala, he's a law professor for Queen's University. If you Google his name, he writes a lot about the importance of the charter to child welfare. So you can download, actually Vern has one of his documents anyways on the Canada Court Watch website. Download that and put it into your affidavits as exhibits. There's another guy called Raleigh Thompson from Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia. He's a law professor as well. He wrote a document which I personally haven't been able to find on the internet yet. Maybe Neil Haskett will be able to find it. But it's called Nothing But the Charter. And it's another one of these documents that talks about the importance of charter rights in child protection litigation. There's a gentleman who I have communicated with once, Joseph Doyle from the MIT University in America, and he has written, he does mathematical examinations of foster care, and he does, he's a math professor, but he has an interest in foster care, and he's written a number of documents which prove mathematically that foster care is one of the worst things that you can do to a kid. I mean, let's be honest. The most abusive thing you can do to a child is to take them out of a loving home, which is what the Children's Aid Society does on a daily basis, uncountable number of times here in the province of Ontario. So we want to help with all of that. Have I forgotten anything? No. Okay, so please, let's just keep perfecting our approach and acquiring more knowledge, and we can't give up because the kids and the families are counting on us. It's a very, very heavy responsibility and burden that we've taken on, but we have absolutely no choice but to continue with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. As always, I enjoy listening to your presentation. Very informative, very factual, and very useful. Before I have Jane back up to talk about self-representation, I want to mention some facts that have come across my way, which you might find interesting. This device I've been using for about 6 years, and I can tell you that a recording device like this to CAS is like holy water to Damien. They absolutely despise, they do not like, they will do anything and everything. I know in some cases they've searched people and take away these devices. They talk about restricting or reducing supervised visitation if such devices like this are brought into Children's Aid. But I'll tell you something. This device that cost me $225 has kept me out of prison. And if I didn't have the evidence that I got on this device, I'd today be in prison on a false sexual allegation. So something that I think everybody should invest in is a digital recorder. Carry it, use it, and record everything and everyone when dealing with the police, the CAS, because you just never know when this device will save your backside. I also want to tell you, I met with Patrick Lake, the executive director of York CAS, many times. And it's very important when we're dealing with CAS, I know we get emotional, that we always treat them respectfully, but we need to be persistent. When my file was closed, I met with Patrick Lake, and he said, "Mr. Vincer, I've got to tell you something. You've been extremely cordial, but very persistent." And he knew that I would never, ever give up, and I would never, ever go away. Some other little facts that I'd like to mention to you, this casket here, Chad Wells was kind enough to build about a dozen of them. This represents the children that die in the care of CAS, which I find entirely unacceptable. This is something that Mr. Lake really hated hearing in the media. He went on to explain that our numbers were wrong, and he did admit that there were some, you know, that they do make mistakes, and some children do die in their care. My question is this. We pay these CAS workers who are unregistered, practicing unlawful social work, $40,000, $50,000, $70,000, executive directors earning $160,000, $80,000 a year. How can it be that we spend $1.5 billion of our tax dollars each year? How could it be that in their care, even one child would die when they are charged to protect children that are at risk of harm? How can that happen? There is no answer to it. I've heard of many stories where they claim that a baby crawled over a fence or under a fence and fell into a pool and died. I just don't understand that, because when my kids were crawling, I knew every second of every minute of every day where exactly they were. They never left my eyesight, ever. But CAS seems to do whatever they want, and like Chris said, they've never been held accountable for these deaths. So at this point, if I could have Jane speak about self-representation.
At this time, I am addressing you as a paralegal. Last time, I was addressing you as a concerned citizen and an advocate on behalf of individuals caught up in the throes of CAS litigation. I wanted to give some suggestions as to how one might approach self-representation in an effective way. There are a lot of resources on the internet available to people now. It's wonderful. All the forms and the rules and case law is posted there. There's a website called Can Lee that has not everything. It doesn't go back. I think the earliest case law there is in the 80s, so it's not everything. You'd have to go to the library for older stuff. But it gives quite a bit of case law, and certainly all the current case law. And it also has all the legislation, so any legislation that might apply to the situation that you're in can be attained there. So I would recommend, if somebody was intending to do self-representation, to start doing as much research on your own as you can. Try and get a sense of what you're after, what you're pursuing. Say if it's small claims court, you know, look at trying to find similar cases as to what you're trying to achieve, and then put together your paperwork as best you can, and then you can utilize the services of a lawyer as a self-represented litigant by bringing that material to the lawyer, having him review it or her review it and give you feedback. As well, you can bring specific questions to a lawyer and pay, or a paralegal, and pay for that legal guidance. But it's a lot cheaper than turning your whole case over to them. For example, I was saying earlier, an individual involved in some sort of conflict knows their case the best. They know the implications, they know the evidence, they know the witnesses, and that sort of thing. And the most time-consuming part of it is documenting that, getting the evidence to support whatever it is that your situation involves, and making a clear, concise statement about what occurred, usually in chronological order. If you just walk into a lawyer's office and say, well, you know, I've got this problem, here you go, they've got to spend a lot of time finding out what happened, then they have to go ahead and do this documentation, and their time is very expensive, as I'm sure most people have found out. So just in terms of preparing the documentation that demonstrates what the facts are in the case, you can reduce the cost by approximately 90% by doing attempting to do it yourself. They can give you some guidance to, you know, to well, other people can as well. They can proofread it for you and give you their feedback, and then the lawyer can assess it for whether it has the necessary elements to demonstrate your case, and they can make recommendations to improve it. But it's time is a lot more reduced. In court, if you're self-represented, the judge, there's case law that requires the judge to help you as much as they can. Like, we don't see that often, but if you bring that case law and then you have a problem, you need leeway or you need guidance or instruction from the court, you can use that case law to demonstrate that the judge really needs to provide that information. And according to Beverly McLaughlin, there is a huge number of people self-representing now. So they're changing rules. For example, the Supreme Court allows a self-litigant to use their library. That was a challenge that a friend of mine brought to her personally, and she changed the requirements for the use. Not anybody can't just go in and use it. Any lawyer can anytime for any reason, but an individual has to be in a legal process that requires that material. So that's well, the Supreme Court library is in Ottawa, unfortunately.
No, but they do it in the individual courthouses. I was very close to in Waterloo. They were going to let me do it.
Yeah.
And in Chatham, I'm working on it right now. You can do
yeah.
it.
Yeah. You can use Beverly McLaughlin's statements about access to justice to support that and the change she made, because it's exactly the same thing, and that's exactly correct. And that their resources are very useful because they have software that's like Canley but more extensive, and it searches more widely or whatever, and they'll often have cases that are going farther back than Canley. So if you can get into those law libraries, almost every court has that. But I don't know about all the different regions, but in Ottawa there's very extensive law libraries in the universities, and an individual is allowed to use those. And the librarians are very astute at finding even old, you know, like strange case law going back, you know. Like
also the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal's library.
Yes.
When I was in Maplehurst in 2010.
Yes.
They sent me hundreds of pages of documents.
Nice.
And so anybody can contact them, and
yeah.
they'll conceivably, if you request the case law,
yeah.
they'll send it.
Yeah, Workers' Compensation Review Board used to have an extensive library too, that, but they would only give it to representatives, although at that time you didn't have to be licensed representative, like anyone who was officially charged with the case. But they wouldn't give it to the individual if they were self-representing. But, That's not correct, because the right to counsel includes the right to the resources that a counsel would be privy to. Mm. So that could be challenged on that. And there's case law that shows the right to counsel includes the right to self-representation. Swan, I think, is the name of the case. Also, the Supreme Court does have cases online, and the Ontario Court of Appeal, and the Ontario Court of Appeal has, and the Supreme Court, you can see that are currently in progress. What's being put up, like all of their affidavits or all their motion and all those types of documents, which are useful in terms of, like you were saying, to rule things or whatever. So if you could find some more cases that what you're trying to do, you can utilize that material as well. Also, lawyer referral is a way of getting very specific information, and they actually do the job about your business. So if you call under those, you have some knowledge, and that's free now. So you call through the lawyer's referral, and sometimes you'll get to talk to several lawyers because they may not be able to take on your case for whatever reason. They don't want to, or there's a conflict or whatever, so you get to talk to another one, and each time you talk to one, you get more information about your case. And also, an advantage of self-representation, you avoid some of the political problems that can occur sometimes in your litigation that you're pursuing. If you're, for example, trying to sue CAS, there's a lot of political support for that agency all through the system. So there's a great deal of pressure on lawyers and paralegals to comply or cooperate with whatever the court is trying to achieve in terms of, you know, supporting the direction, most times, supporting the direction that Children's Aid wants to go. Myself, I've been a paralegal for about 23 years, but I didn't get licensed until November last year, but I didn't activate my license until June. 3 weeks later, I went to a Child and Family Services Review Board meeting with Sophie X as her support person, which is how I've acted entirely through the whole thing. And on the basis of that meeting, Children's Aid made a complaint to the Law Society about me trying to get my license, or trying to, I guess, sever my support from that individual so she would be more vulnerable. And I won it, so I was really happy. And I really get a good, really got a good outcome, because they didn't just say there wasn't enough evidence to support their complaint. They said the evidence showed that there was no violation, there was no one taken advantage of, blah 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 blah. So
is that decision posted to Canada?
I'm not sure. Did they do that?
Law Society decisions are posted to Canada.
Well, I'll check into that, because I would like to put it up there. I'm really pleased with it. It was like, you know, you would expect that, because of the politics that often goes on, you'd expect some kind of little jab in the process, but there wasn't. It was really, really good. But I mean, what I'm trying to show you is that's what they do. That's what they do when lawyers go against them or paralegals go against them. They take aggressive complaints and try and impede them, and it's time consuming. I had to make 2 responses, and it probably took me something like 6 or 8 hours to respond to it. They said that I made a serious accusation without providing proof, and that accusation was that their actions were likely to cause death, and without proof. And what I had given as proof is a 40 well I didn't give it Sophie presented that in a motion, a 40-page document showing the harm of maternal deprivation, like it was a sort of a synopsis of the research. And the judge ordered that her visits be extended by 1 visit a week, plus ordered that she could visit her child in the neonatal unit of the Children's Hospital if hospital staff was present, which is all the time, so that means any time. But when she went to visit the child, Chio, and we have this on tape, Chio said no, and she said, well, I have a court order here, and they said, we take our direction from CAS. and the child almost died from that. And that was what we were trying to address at the Child and Family Services Review Board. And it was a settlement conference. It was like totally appropriate to raise it there, and in the way in which we raised it. And there is other research that states or asserts that this condition that the child had, which is low sodium level, that affect the blood pressure, and she just had open heart surgery. The literature suggests that this condition of low sodium is caused by emotional distress. So I dare say no maternal contact for 2 days, which is what occurred before she went into that condition, would certainly qualify. Example of what Chris was talking about earlier, about there seems to be some sort of motivation there to escalate the risks, because the mother has never harmed a child ever. And they had a warrant this time, and they said they were taking the child from a place of danger to a place of safety. Well, it was always in the same unit. They were just blocking the mother and not putting any substitute person. She had nobody for the first week, and then the foster parents that have the first child took the second child on, but only visited once a week for 1 hour. So Sophie had 4 hours, or 4 visits, 1.5 hours each. Foster parents came one visit for 1 hour, and then nobody there on the weekend. Like, how's that from a place? And Sophie's a very responsible, you know, she would have been there, well, she was there all the time anyway, and they wouldn't let her see the baby. So I would suggest that people at least look at the possibility of doing self-representation before they take on the high cost of legal representation. And if it is a situation where there's a lot of politics happening, I would strongly recommend self-representation over being represented by a licensed party, because that increases the element of politics in it. So I have cards here, and I have the resources that I talked about are on my website, so you can just link from there instead of searching them all over. And it's the links for the forms and the rules, and there's a lawyer by the name of Simon Shields that you can pay him to do documents in litigation, various forms of litigation, human rights complaints, stuff like that, and he works through online. So there's a link to his stuff, and there's a lot of information that he's put on his website as well that people can access when they're looking at the different courses of action that he supports. So I have a couple. No, am I done? I was just going to ask if there's any specific questions for this topic. Is there any questions that anybody has about self-representation? Anything on their mind? But how to...
That's right. Non-lawyer legal counsel, you're able to do that 3 times a year. Private citizens are able to be a non-lawyer legal counsel 3 times a year for other people, especially in front of, for example, the Child and Family Services Review Board, or the Ontario Human Rights Commission, stuff like that. So Canada Court Watch members who feel that they're ready to do that, they can act as non-lawyer legal counsel 3 times a year. There are a few...
Where did they get that 3 times a year thing?
It's one of the Law Society's bylaws.
I don't remember seeing that 3 times a year.
That's what they said in the recent proceeding that I was involved in.
I think they made that up, because the rule is for someone being entitled to self or to represent, it's that you're not acting in any professional capacity, and you're not taking any money for it. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe there was a number of times on it.
Well, that's what it was explained to us. It's a bylaw. It's a Law Society bylaw.
I'll look it up.
They also said that you can't receive compensation, and you also have to be a friend of the person who you're acting.
Yeah. But there are still limitations, because in Superior Court, there's another rule, like there's the law, there's law society rules, and then there's actual court rules that prohibit non-lawyers from representation, so you have to get leave from the court. But there's case law to support it. There's McKenzie Friend and all of those type of case law that would likely lead to an approval from the Superior Court, even when it's not allowed. But all the lower courts are free to represent, and I believe in summary criminal as well. I don't think you have to.
So you think that that Carswell and Quick Law are better law databases than Canley?
I find more on there. I find it easier to. It has more search options. Like I find Canley. If you know exactly what you're looking for on Canley, but if you get one dot out of place, does it? You can't get it. It just doesn't. It's not as smart of a search. I found it easier on those other systems.
And also. Also, if you get into the law library,
yeah,
you can get copies of that 2004 best practices in the conduct of a child protection file, and
yeah,
the 2007 the DVDs
guidelines.
You can.
Good.
Those are probably two of the best resources for learning about child protection litigation.
Absolutely. So so I hope people take advantage of some of the suggestions that were made here today about getting more actively involved, and at the end of the day, like Chris said, it is it is the person's own case, and it really is ultimately their responsibility. So it's important to understand what's going on. Even if you do choose to turn the case over to the lawyer, it's not a good idea to just say, here, take care of this. You know, you want to be watching what's going on. You want to see the material before it's submitted to the court. You may want to take a second opinion if you don't find the position to be reasonable or sound, that kind of thing. And it's a good idea to remember it's your case. Okay, that's it.
Before we move on to our next speaker, I'd like to take a moment, an opportunity, to bring up some of our younger Canadian citizens, some children that.